No problems, that's a good dose of Dharma won't cure. No, this is it. No, I get it. You didn't hear what I said. No problems that a good dose of Dharma won't cure. Well, no one gets my humor. I remember Geshe Tech joke when we were at Manjushri Institute. He would tell some joke, some Tibetan joke, and he'd be laughing and laughing. The translator translated, and we'd all be going. So before we start, I've gotten some emails. I've forgotten the names of people and their faces. So is Joseph Lam in this class? You're Joseph. That's what you wanted to see one day lunch. Okay. And then two people with the last name Tan? Oh, okay. Are you related? No, okay. But just happen to have the same name. Okay, now I got it. Thank you. Sorry. So let's begin with a little meditation. Calm your body, relax your body, relax your mind, which I mean by that, the initial relaxing, reminding yourself that you don't have to think about anything that has been on your mind up till now, or plans of the future right now. This is just for meditation and motivation. And in a state of just very relaxed state of mind, just observe the breathing as we've begun to do, recognizing when you're breathing in, and particularly the end point after the inhalation, just when it's changing, keep your attention there, recognizing when you're breathing out to try to calm the mind. Let go of other thoughts. And as before, follow one breath, one inhalation up to the crown of your head, to your throat, to your heart. Leave your attention there. Let go of watching the breathing. And instead, watch the clarity of your mind, your mental consciousness. Don't consider any thoughts that come up as bad, you know, hindrances. They help you to define that which you're looking for, the spaciousness of the mind. Those thoughts sort of emerge from the clarity of your mind and dissolve back into it. In the same way that when we have problems in life, rather than thinking that's only a problem, that we train ourselves to see those problems as opportunities for growth in our Dharma practice. They become our gurus. Let the appearance of your body absorb back into that clear light nature and focus on the consciousness that was just a moment before cognizing the body, perceiving the body. Try to use the glue of mindfulness, the mental factor of mindfulness. Once you've recognized a couple of times this clarity and you have it, it's a familiar object to you, try to use your mindfulness to keep it in mind. When you lose it, try to recall it and bring it back. Or notice the thoughts within the mind and use the logic that where those thoughts are present, there has to be the clear and knowing entity of the mind. Focus on that clarity. Within the vast ocean of your mind, this clarity of your mind, you may still be aware of the sense of yourself as an observer, the self, me, I. Almost, you know, in the sense that the body was, when we were focusing on it, before we let go of it, it seemed to be irrefutably there, the presence, palpably there, findable. Now the sense of the self, innate sense of the self that has arisen this lifetime due to familiarity in previous lifetimes, so it's innate to us. That seems to be also almost irrefutable. Try to recognize that sense of the I that makes a separation between you and the consciousness that you're trying to observe is just an appearance within the mind. Let that dissolve back into the clear light nature. There's just mind. Be like the definition of a dakini or dhaka. The Tibetan word for dakini is kandroma. Ka means space, the space of, well, you could say the spaciousness of your mind, the ultimate nature of your mind, conventional nature of your mind. And dro means to go, to travel. So dive into the spaciousness of your mind. Let go of the self. Let go of the body. This clear light nature is always there, so it's not as though it itself is precious, but the awareness of it, the wisdom, understanding that clear light nature is very rare, very precious. It's the same way with emptiness and the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Think how fortunate I am to be able to perceive this, to be inspired, to let go of my delusions, that I can remove them from my mind because they don't stain my mind. They're not an integral part of my mind. By applying the antidotes, I can let go of the deluded states of mind. I can develop my wisdom, know more, remember more, develop my kindness, my compassion. The Buddha, in his many Dharma teachings, taught many times how rare it was to find a situation like this as a human being with the freedom and the endowments, these special qualities that we enjoy, to be able to give us the freedom to practice the Dharma. So thinking of taking refuge in the Buddha's teachings, his Dharma, not just the scriptural teachings, but your realizations of them. And depending on the spiritual friends, the Sangha, the community of ordained Sangha, and even the lay Sangha, I think I'm going to listen to the talk tonight and next Thursday. To acquire the medicine to cure myself ultimately, deep healing, dharma healing. If you have the antidote, if you know the antidotes to our delusions and you never take them, it's like having the medicine to cure your illness and just carrying it in a big sack on your back or in your pocket. What are we going to do with these qualities? Well, we ourselves will find a peace of mind. Even if we strive for the welfare of others, we'll find a peace of mind even greater than the lesser vehicle, nirvana. Thinking all the people that you encounter today here in Singapore, even the animals, the insects, those beings that might remain unseen to others, spirits of various kinds, all have been, in previous lives, our mother, and will again be our intimate friends and mothers in future lives, as long as we're circling in cyclic existence. For their welfare, I'm going to try to perfect myself to be less harmful, to actually have positive qualities so that I can benefit them, not simply by avoiding harm, but by actually leading them, inspiring them, giving teachings, leading them out of samsara into enlightenment. For that reason, I'm going to participate in the teachings tonight. That's my goal. That's my destination. It may be, who knows? Maybe someone will attain enlightenment this lifetime. Maybe in the not-so-distant future. Maybe many lifetimes in the future. But that's our goal. Whatever life we find ourselves in, to pray that we'll always have that inspiration in the back of our minds. That's my goal, that's my destination. And then relax. Relax your body, relax your mind. Bring your attention back to the present. How was your meditation? Any observation? They say, American way, say, anyone want to share? It sounds very American, doesn't it? Yes.
I wonder why you always ask us to focus on the spaciousness of the mind. When the mind actually has two aspects, a knowing nature and a clear nature.
Right.
So I presume that spaciousness refers to clarity.
Yeah.
So isn't focusing on doing nature the mind easier, the awareness part?
So he knows the answer already, but he's like many times when Lama Zopa, when we were in study with Geshe Zopa, Lama Zopa would ask some question very humbly, like, oh, so that Geshe Zopa would tell the answer for the other people. So generally, you can think the general nature of the mind, or its general aspect that it projects, is clarity, this clearness, intangibility, unobstructiveness. And its function is to know. So they're slightly different. One is its kind of its how it presents itself as an object, and the other is its function. These two things that you said are aspects of it. So generally, you're using one moment of the consciousness to try to perceive that clarity. You could say technically the previous moment of consciousness. And maybe that's not as important, unless that bothers you. You know, if you, you know, cause and effect. But the very fact that you're perceiving an object, you understand the quality of knowing of that, of the consciousness. So in one sense, you're aware of the knowing of the present instant and the clarity of the previous instant. Could you perceive the knowing of the previous instant? How would you know that? You have a sort of memory of the aspect that the consciousness was presenting to you, the previous instant of consciousness, this clarity and immateriality. So something to think about. The present consciousness that's remembering just the previous thought instant, so almost instantaneous. You could almost say it's like knowing the consciousness at that time, essentially. It's knowing the clarity of that consciousness. And that knowing is that second, what you said, second aspect. That's the function of the mind. So they're both present in this observation. Okay. Someone else want to share? Just joking. It's the New Age American way, you know. Okay. So, yeah. So last time we were finishing up the last class, I was introducing some antidotes, some practical meditation, practical methods to overcome anger, hatred and anger, right? Do you remember what I said? There were this one famous Kadampa Geshe Chenghua. Geshe Chenghua, I think it wasn't just his own invention. It was probably something that was very common amongst the Kadampa Geshes, but in his writings, it was written down, these four methods. Do you remember what they were? What was it? The arrow and the target. Is that two? Or is that one method? That's one. Okay. And then what's another one? What? What did she say?
Compassion.
Compassion. Right? And then one. Oh, someone's calling. I hope it's okay. Guru. And then the last one we said wisdom, right? So we'd gone through the first three a little bit. We can go over again. You know that the first one involves karma. So when you notice anger rising, It's a state. It's a klesha, right? Klesha or affliction or delusion. It's something that shakes the clarity of your mind. Now, at that point, not so easy to see the clarity of your mind. It disturbs the calmness, and it gives rise to the creation of negative karma, and also burning up your virtuous karma, that perpetuating that state. So you need to be like someone going to war with the delusions. You have to think of yourself as a sort of Dharma warrior and to apply the antidotes to that. So one way to do it is to think about karma and this particular way of thinking about karma. Right now there's some situation. Maybe someone is arguing with you, or they've taken your money, or they haven't done something that you wanted them to, or whatever. Or even if it's not a person, you know, it's raining. You were planning on, you'd worn your nice clothes, you were going out for a walk, now it's raining and your nice clothes are getting wet. Maybe you're getting angry at the sky or the weather. You know, it doesn't have to be anger, just at a person. And you can think, okay, this is almost like a target, this situation, the person who said some harsh words or harmed you in some way, or the rain. There's no way that you could experience that as uncomfortable or as suffering unless you'd created the karma in the past. This is one of the essential elements in understanding karma. We'll give a couple of lectures on karma in the coming days, I think just after the break for New Year's and everything. We'll go into more detail about karma, but there's no way you can experience a result without having created the karma. So somewhere in the past, it's almost as though we had shot an arrow, and it has been, essentially what it means is we planted a seed in our consciousness, a karmic seed, waiting for the right opportunity. And that it's almost as though that arrow was traveling through time, just waiting for the right cooperative condition. Does it make sense? You look a little bit, with the New York logo on your shirt, you look like... Does it make sense to you? Do you understand my words at least? Yeah. Okay. I thought you had an expression like, what's he talking? Almost as the analogy here. It's just an analogy. Almost that action that you created is continuing. Actually, when we talk in the higher tenets, we talk about actions as being even when they cease, even the cessation of an action. Do you remember in Prasangika philosophy, those of you who study, even the cessation of an action is a functioning thing? You might think, what? You know, you want to think that the action deposited a seed. That's the usual analogy we use in the consciousness, kind of agricultural analogy. But in the Prasangika point of view, the action has ceased in the past. Maybe you harmed others in some way, you said harsh words. And that, even the cessation, is, there's a word in Tibetan, shikpa. That's a functioning thing. So it's, the analogy of the arrow is quite apt here in that higher view. Something's continuing on, and when the right cooperative condition arises, the arrow can hit the target, and you experience that. So what is this helping you to understand? First of all, by trying to apply an antidote and using this, you're taking your attention away from the situation which is instigating the anger, right? You're turning your attention away from it, and so you're not constantly fueling that anger at that moment. And not only are you not fueling it, you're applying a particular way of thinking that will cause that angry state of mind to be pacified. Because the angry state of mind is one that exaggerates the situation in various ways, finds it uncomfortable, exaggerates the faults, and wants to be rid of them. So that exaggeration of the faults, which is in a sense like inappropriate attention, one of the ways we exaggerate the faults is that this is not my fault. This is, the fault is out there. You know, either the weather or God or the person. So this not only takes your attention away from the anger-provoking situation, so your mind calms a little, and now you're applying the antidote. It's like withdrawing from the projection of your mind was projecting. It's the fault is out there somewhere. And looking back here, the fault is with my previous continuum. When I shot that arrow, when I created that action in the past. Okay? Remember, we talked a little bit about that last time. You recall? Then compassion. Another projection of our mind, incorrect projection, that fuels the anger, is thinking almost like the archetypal plantation owner. You know, no, you just what you wouldn't call slaves. What do you call the people that work for you on the plantation? Slaves? No. Workers. Maybe in America in earlier times the African Americans that were brought over were actually slaves. They had no freedom, and the owners of the cotton, that's how the cotton industry became very big. They had a mindset that they are suitable to be beaten. You know, anything that irritated them. There's no compassion in some people's minds. Some people, of course, there were many compassionate people. So one part of our mind that instigates and continues the anger is that projection that it's that person, it's okay. They deserve it. They deserve my wrath or my anger or they need it. But compassion is a state of mind that recognizes that they're not suitable to be harmed. They are like us. They want to be happy. They want to be free of suffering. The famous advice of the Buddha. Very, very profound. Even that one little sentence, we are all equal in wanting to be happy and to be free of suffering. You might say, well, that doesn't sound very profound. But that one reasoning alone, even when His Holiness talks about developing compassion on higher levels, that particular reasoning can be used to develop a deep insight into our equality with others. And if you have a little insight into the emptiness of yourself, you could recognize being equal with all others in that fundamental way, wanting to be free of suffering and to have happiness, that I could start to think of their welfare. Why should I think of only my welfare? This body has come about because of two elements that I had no connection with. Father's sperm, mother's ovum. I entered into that and I sort of like I squatted in this apartment. Do you have that here? Is that a New York thing? You know what like squatters are? You don't own the property, but you just go in and then you sort of claim it as your own. Or you put up boards to keep other people out and locks. Does that happen in Singapore? Some people say yes, some people say no. Okay, you're different neighborhoods. It does? Yeah, oh, yeah. So you could think like that. We're squatting in this, you know, we've added that little ovum, that fertilized ovum has gotten bigger and bigger because we've had nutrition. First mom gave us through her, was it amniotic fluid, is that the right term? And then through her milk, and then father and mother brought food, and we became bigger and bigger. We identified this part of our identity, that this is me, but we could identify with all other living beings. Because basically we are exactly equal with them in wanting to be free, wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. So, and also to recognize that this person, like me, wants to be free of suffering. Even if they've done something wrong, they want to think that they are forgiven. The example I gave before is if you go to your aunt's house and you spill something on their precious carpet, stain, you know, is going to be maybe, you know, ink or something, and you're afraid you're going to be yelled at and kicked out of the family or something like this, you know. Leave. And instead they say, oh, that's okay. Doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. Have you, you know, such a soothing word to hear, such soothing words to hear if you've done something wrong. In the same way, other people don't want to hear, you know, our harsh words back or our anger or to feel any kind of retribution. So that helps to meditate on compassion. First of all, thinking that's the antidote while the anger is there. You take your attention away from the anger-provoking situation, so it's diffused a little, and then you're applying an antidote to withdraw that particular projection, that the wrong view that it's okay to strike out. Here, this particular mind that you're trying to cultivate, we could call compassion, is one of the mental factors we'll talk about today when we talk about the 11 virtuous mental factors. Those of you who've studied before, which mental factor is that? Do you know? Okay. Do you know? Back there. Which one? Faith? Is that what you said? Faith? F-A-I-T-H? It's the virtuous mental factor called, in Sanskrit, very famous, that Gandhi, you know what Gandhi, the Indian, Mahatma Gandhi, what did he say? Nonviolence. Ahimsa. Have you ever heard of that? Himsa means harm or violence. And ahimsa, remember we talked in one of the classes, the letter A is a negative particle in Sanskrit. So some words begin with A and they're not negatives, but this is the A. So non-harmfulness, which is not just at that point you're not harming. It's the actual antidote to harm. It's compassion. Its essence is compassion. So that's good to know. So that's the second one. And then we talked also last time about recognizing that one of the things that can instigate the anger is the sense that this is only a problem. I don't need this. you know, it's something I can do without. It has no redeeming feature. It's just, you know, bad. But to recognize instead, taking your attention away from that, applying this antidote of the situation being like your guru, to recognize we do need this. This is giving us the opportunity, because the fact that we were getting angry about it, or you know, other things, you know, other things. If you notice jealousy arising, and your mind is upset, thinking this is my guru also. All the different things. They're your guru in the sense that they're giving you the opportunity to apply the antidote to those afflictions. So, as I said, the guru is not always just always holding your face, and sometimes the guru will confront your ego, you know, tell you you're wrong, and then you tell the guru, no, you're wrong, I'm not wrong, you're wrong. And just recognizing that. So the fourth antidote of these four, and there's many other antidotes too, but kind of encompassing many main topics, is to withdraw from the object one projection of your mind that's instigating the anger of ignorance, a projection of ignorance. So we could say there's two levels. Geshe Chenghua mainly was talking about meditating on the wisdom of emptiness. But for many of us, that's a new, that's something that we don't quite have a clear understanding of. We can say the conventional wisdom of impermanence, which Lama Yeshe, my teacher Lama Yeshe, used to say, until you realize emptiness, the wisdom of impermanence is almost like an atom bomb to blow up your delusions, really understanding that. So to recognize that this will pass, that this situation is, you know, the ignorant mind almost feels one element of its, the irritating quality of the situation is that although you're not enunciating it in words in your mind, but it's almost as though it's going to continue, it's going to endure unless you strike out, right? Unless you do something quickly about it. So this is taking away that projection of permanence and instead looking back and reminding yourself that this will pass. One thing I found very useful in this regard, I've seen it recently in some other Dharma discourse, just to recall how things in the past were problematic when you were a kid, maybe some similar kind of situation arose, you were really upset about something, and then that passed, and days later you forgot about it, and even the person who might have harmed you or whatever, you became friends. So to keep that in mind, that this is all changing. I think I told you the story, I'm not sure I told it this time, when I lived in I was teaching in Beirut, Lebanon, before I came to India and Nepal, where I met the Dharma in 1974. I think 72, 73, 74, I was teaching in Beirut. Do you know where Beirut is? In the Mediterranean. I had a friend, a guy. He and I rented a house up in the mountains. I taught in the school down along the sea, American students. And it was nice. I had an apartment there, but then in the weekends I'd go up to this little mountain town. And my friend, unbeknownst to me, had been sending back some contraband. I won't say what it was. You can figure out what it was. He was rolling it out, putting it in aluminum foil, and sending it in Christmas cards to his friends in America to see if they got it. And I guess they did, and so he was thinking, what he did was, another fellow came to visit, one of his other buddies, and they hired some local carpenter to make cages for pigeons. They were going to send pigeons back to the United States in wooden cages, and what they did is they made laminate. You know what laminate is? When you put layers of wood, very, very thin wood, then a layer of the contraband, then a layer of wood, layer, so it was like. And I think the carpenter told the police about it, and they were arrested. And I remember going to see my friend, his name was Steve, I remember to see him in the Lebanese jail. You've heard how bad some of the, maybe even Singapore jail might be bad, I don't know, but you've heard, nowadays what is famous, the Thai prisons and the Vietnamese prisons, maybe a little bit like that, or Turkish prisons. So it wasn't good, and he was a good-looking guy. I think he was already, the first day I got to see him after he had been arrested, I think he'd already been sexually assaulted and, you know, this sort of thing. And I went to him. It was an outdoor place where you could see the people one at a time. There were bars between him and me. And I said, how are you doing? And he said, this too will pass. Have you heard that expression? This too will pass. We'd read that together and marveled at that in the writings of some Sufi masters. That's a wisdom of impermanence, isn't it? To remind yourself, this will pass, to give you even though at the moment your mind is grasping that this is one of the reasons you're finding it unbearable is that it's enduring. But to just, it's almost like letting go of that projection by reminding yourself that this will pass. If you have an understanding of emptiness, of selflessness, you can ask yourself, who is it that seems to be irritated? Because the sense of the self within your mind, your own self-identity, grasping to that is real, and that's something you usually want to cherish, that has been somehow been threatened or is suffering. And so to recognize that the self that you're imagining does not exist at all, if you have an insight into selflessness, that the source, that's the fundamental source, the root source that's fueling the anger is undermined, and the anger can disappear in a second. Okay? So those are these four methods you can remember. And you need to train in them. It's not as though at the moment anger is coming, you've got it on your phone and there's some anger-provoking situation, you're getting angry, and then you say, well, let me look at my cell phone, George said something about that. And you try to, okay. At that point, that's too late, right? It's like if Sui Kim and I had joined the Singapore Army and we were supposed to be in basic training to learn how to the artillery and all of this stuff. We're just goofing off. We're watching videos or reading comics or something. Then when the battle is going on, you know, I say to Sui Kim, you know, fire the cannon. And he says, well, how do I fire? At that point, the enemy is coming. It's not, to try to read the manual at the last minute. So you need to train. That's what basic training is. So basic training is in your meditation seat. Apply these antidotes in the safety of your meditation seat, not on the bus, not in the street where you're arguing with someone or, you know, putting your fist at the sky for raining or whatever. Bring to mind some situations that have caused anger and apply these antidotes. Sometime one or the other of them may be more effective in particular situations. Okay? But get used to them. Like in the basic army training, maybe you learn how to throw hand grenades and also how to shoot rifles or shoot the artillery and different kinds of weapons. Here your enemy is much more dangerous, your delusions. Fundamentally, your ignorance. And so you need to be prepared. Don't say to yourself, I'm a pacifist, therefore I'm not going to apply these antidotes. Okay, my bad humor again, okay. You might say, in the army, you might say, I'm a pacifist, I'm not going to throw hand grenades or shoot the cannons. Here, you're fighting the inner enemy, right? Not an outer enemy. You're fighting the only enemy that's worth really trying to annihilate, your own delusions. It's unsuitable to try to annihilate the outer enemy, but it's suitable to try to annihilate these inner enemies. Okay. Some question? Something unclear? Cici, did you? Is that okay? All right. So let's go next. What we were going to go over last time, where we just started, the 10 virtuous states of mind. Okay, 10? How many virtuous states of mind are there? 10? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, but this is seeing if you agreed with me. Are there 10 virtuous states of mind? You don't like it when I do that. You say, why does he change that? How many virtuous states of mind are there? 11. Does that mean there are really only 11 virtuous states of mind? Those are the only virtuous states of mind you can have? No. It means those are representative of the major virtuous states of mind by their, let's say, by their nature. The virtuous mental factors are citta and cittana. So they are faith, which is what you were talking about one before, faith, shame, and embarrassment. I say them together because they're very similar, related. Faith, shame, embarrassment. Then what are called the three roots of virtue: non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance. So what are the three, when I say the three roots of virtue, sometimes we say the three poisonous minds are the three roots of non-virtue. All of the other negative states of mind come out of attachment, hatred, and ignorance. So these are non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance. But in the same way that I mentioned before about non-harmfulness, ahimsa, these three are not simply the lack of attachment or hatred or ignorance. They are actually antidotes to them. So we'll talk about what those are. So what did we say? Faith, shame, embarrassment, then the three roots of virtue: non-attachment, non-hatred, non-ignorance. That's six. Then sundru, or the one you know as joyful effort. Again, this doesn't mean the ordinary effort that people use in the world to make money or to, you know, to overcome, you know, to get wealth or to get power over others or to get working so hard to become political or famous or whatever, become number one on Facebook or what was it, YouTube? Does anyone here have their own YouTube channel? I'm just curious. No? Okay, good. That's better. Don't. So, effort, that's positive state of mind, joyful effort. Then pliancy, which we've talked about before, is a particular, there's two kinds of pliancy, physical pliancy and mental pliancy. This refers to the mental pliancy, I think. And then something very similar to shame and embarrassment, conscientiousness. And then the last two, equanimity. We'll talk about this in detail. This is a mental factor. It's not the equanimity of, you know, may all sentient beings be free of hatred and, you know, attachment. It's not the equanimity feeling between pleasant and unpleasant. This is a particular mental factor when you're developing calm abiding, and you no longer have to put effort into watching the mind so carefully and applying the antidotes. You can just sort of coast along. That effort that you were using up to that point becomes a hindrance at that point. And you have to have a state of equanimity and let go that mental factor. And the last one is the one we just were talking about in the antidotes, non-harmfulness. Ahimsa. Okay. So, first one, faith. Faith is generally a state of mind that makes is a virtuous mental factor. It's a virtue by its very nature. If it's present in your mind, you're creating virtuous karma at that moment. So this is something useful to think. It's very useful to if someone is dying, if you can instill in them, if they have in their lifetime had faith in the Buddha and the Dharma Sangha or even in Christ or whatever, to let them die with a state of faith because it's a virtuous state of mind. So there's three divisions of faith, and sort of the defining characteristics of faith come out as we talk about them. We talk about lucid faith, the faith of conviction, and the faith which is a desire to attain some higher qualities. So what does that mean? Faith, lucid faith is a state of mind that's engendered partially maybe because of karmic instincts in your past lives when you see or hear of people or things such as the Dharma or the Sangha that are praiseworthy, that are good and virtuous, and you encounter them when that state of mind rises of faith. A little bit like the example that's given sometime was called lucid faith. Like there's metaphorical or maybe some talk of a magical stone that when you put in the water that is dirty, turbid, it causes the water to become limpid and clear. What do they call that? It was a water clarifying jewel. When that's put in water, the dirtiness in the water is immediately cleansed. So when this type of faith, lucid faith, is generated in the continuum, mental troubles are cleared away, whereupon the qualities of realizations are suitable to be generated. So, yeah. Like just to have faith in your teachers, Lama Sopa Rinpoche, Ken Rinpoche, in the Buddha, in the Dharma. If you can recall the good qualities of those beings and generate faith in them, in their qualities, that state of mind creates virtuous karma and is like that cleaning of the water from becoming dirty to clear. Like when we do our meditation at the beginning, we're watching the nature of the mind and letting the thoughts subside, almost like the mud falling to the bottom of the water, and the water becoming clear and limpid. And then within that state, you have some space to work on the mind. You can develop good qualities. So first one is called lucid faith or limpid faith. How else do they translate that? Have you heard another translation? What is it? Clear faith, yeah. We call it clear. Clarifying maybe, or clear faith. Then the second one is called the faith of conviction. This is the strongest of the faiths. This is the faith that comes about through your understanding this lifetime, analyzing, like say, faith in the law of cause and effect, having heard the Buddha's teachings, analyzed them in your mind, weighed the truth of them, heard about the Buddha's teachings about past and future lives, subtle points, developed some conviction in that. Do you know what conviction means? What's another way of saying conviction? Not being convicted by the jail. Belief, having belief, yeah. Faith of belief, you could call it also, faith of conviction. So this one is in some ways more durable than the clear faith or lucid faith, limpid faith that we just talked about, the first division. Because that is not necessarily based on a lot of deep analysis. That may be due to imprints from previous lives, inborn in you, a certain faith in certain qualities, or your likings, but that can be destroyed more easily. The faith of conviction being based on some kind of reasonings and your thinking, you've come to believe something for some reasons, that's the faith that we would like to try to develop as a basis for taking refuge. Faith, you need to have, remember the two main causes, what were they, of refuge? When you take refuge, you know the two main causes? Fear and faith, right? FF. So fear and faith. Even if you don't have faith, I said, at the beginning, you need at least hope. Do you remember I was talking about that? That the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can help you. But you want to change that hope into faith. The faith of conviction. Okay, that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are really, you've analyzed their qualities and so forth, and that they really are the reliable objects that you can take refuge in. The third kind of faith is the faith that strives for higher qualities. Let's see what it says here. Wish to, faith of conviction, a wish to attain with respect to that which exists, such as actions and their effects, karma and their effects, karma and results. Wish to obtain power, such as the powers of the path to actualize cessation. You know, how to bring about the cessation of the delusions by meditating, developing these realizations. So faith has the function of serving as a basis for aspiration. We talked about that in either this... Yeah, when we talked about aspiration, we said that the cause of aspiration... Now, aspiration is kind of like the mother of all good qualities. Aspiration means, you know, sort of like wanting to attain something. If you want something, and that you may then put effort into attaining it, and that effort is what will bring it about. But that, where does the aspiration come about? How does it, if we want to generate stronger aspiration in our mind that we want to develop bodhicitta and so forth, you need to have faith in those qualities. Say faith in the qualities of bodhicitta, or faith in the qualities of calm abiding and so forth. So we talked about the faith of clarity is the clarity of mind that comes through perceiving the qualities of the three jewels. It's called clarifying because just as when a water clarifying jewel is put in water, the dirtiness in the water is immediately cleansed. So when this type of faith is generated in the continuum, mental problems are cleared away. Whereupon the qualities of realization are suitable to be generated. It's like having a clean laboratory to work in. The faith of conviction, for example, is the gaining of conviction in dependent arising. What's dependent arising? Do you know what that means? It has various levels of meaning. Dependent arising can mean independence on this cause, effects will arise. So it can mean, in a simple sense, especially in the Theravada, it often means just the law of cause and effect as applied to the karma. Karma, do you think of it that way? Karma actually means action, right? Actions, maybe the word action in our mind doesn't sound like it's necessarily going to have a result. It's just like an action, like the machine is acting or I'm acting. But when we say the two words that often come together, we say karma, phala. Phala means result or fruit, you know, maturation. So it's essentially talking about cause and effect within our mental continuum. Negative actions necessarily give rise to something uncomfortable, suffering in the future. Virtuous actions are defined by those actions that will bring about some pleasant result in the future. Neutral actions are those which, by their very nature, bring about results that are not perceived as pleasurable or unpleasurable, just sort of like neutral feeling. So faith of conviction is, for instance, gaining conviction in dependent arising or in actions and their effects through contemplating these doctrines as set forth by the Buddha, the conqueror. Why is the Buddha called the conqueror? Did he conquer? When the Buddha was alive, did he become king of all of India? Did he conquer all of India? Kashmir? Where did he conquer? Why is he called the conqueror? Do you know why he's called the conqueror? He's called the conqueror because he conquered the delusions. It's called Jina. Not G-E-E-N-A. Like there's some movie star named Jina, right? J-I-N-A. Like there's a word that is a synonym for the bodhisattvas. We call them the Jinaputra. What would Jinaputra mean? Putra means what, do you know? It's son. Or you say child. Jinaputra would mean son of the conqueror. In the same way that we say Rajaputra. Have you heard, there's a town in India called Rajput. Rajaputra. So the prince, the son of the king, the Raja is the king. You've heard Raja, right? Maharaja, great king, emperor. So the Raja, when the king has a son, the son is called Rajaputra. And immediately is respected by the ministers and the populace because he will eventually become king, unless he dies or something like that, right? In the same way, the bodhisattvas, when they develop bodhicitta, they're called Jinaputra, because they will become a Jina, a conqueror of the delusions. They will eventually become a Buddha. So here it says developing conviction in the teachings of the conqueror, the Buddha. The faith which is a wish to attain, this third faith, is, for instance, the faith thinking, I must definitely attain the cessation of suffering. I will. Upon contemplating the Four Noble Truths, ascertaining true sufferings, and what are the sources of the true sources, contemplating true cessations and the paths that bring them about, realizing that in striving in the proper way, these can be attained. So developing some conviction, you know, understanding the stages, how to develop bodhicitta, for instance. You have to first have recognize, for instance, all living beings as having been your mother. You know, one path to bring that about. What was the next stage? Remembering their kindness, feeling an obligation to repay their kindness. As a result of that, developing what's called heartwarming love, affectionate love. Then what? Great compassion. And the exceptional thought, the thought that takes the responsibility to alleviate the suffering of them. Those are called the six causes. And the seventh is the result. Whenever you have causes, you have a result. What's the result? Bodhicitta. So analyzing that, thinking, wow, I can do this. You know, come on. It's just, it's not easy to recognize all sentient beings have been your mother, but you can kind of see that. So developing some understanding, some conviction in that this is something that can be attained, that kind of faith that thinks, I can attain that. I have faith. I can become a Buddha. I can develop bodhicitta. This is the third kind of faith. Okay? Here, I think in Tibetan, it's interesting because I think the text that Jeffrey was translating from says this. To me, this is not something that we usually say, in my sense. He says, although the world equates faith and liking, they are not the same. Liking one's child or spouse and liking beer are cases of liking, but not faith. I guess maybe, I think it's something to do with how the word is used in Tibetan. Because we usually don't say, I have faith in beer or something like that. Right? So I'll leave that out. Okay. So here's another one. Faith and respect. Let's say with respect to the gurus, or the Buddhas. When we study guru devotion in the Lan Rim, these two topics come up. You want to try to develop faith and respect in the guru. They're not the same thing. They're slightly different. Almost sounds the same, though, doesn't it? Have respect to your guru, respect to Ken Rinpoche, to Lama Zopa. Faith in Lama Zopa or the Dalai Lama. So what's the difference? In the Lan Rim, we have divisions in how to properly rely upon a spiritual friend, guru, if you want. One is how to develop faith by remembering their what? Qualities, right? And how to develop respect by remembering their... Who remembers? So someone said, you're studying for the final, right? Aren't you studying for the final? The BP finals? So what should it be? So the two different divisions in the Lan Rim outlines is Sui Kim, remember the first. Developing faith by remembering their qualities and developing respect by developing or remembering their what? Kindness. Good. Okay. I'll try to talk to Benny and let him know that. That one you've already answered. If that's on the exam, you already got that. It's a good review. So, they're a little bit research. So, for instance, to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you have to have faith in them as objects that can protect you, right? So that, that warm feeling that brings about your devotion to the guru and serving them and so forth, which also depends on remembering their kindness. So you have to have a certain kind of respect. Even doesn't really, this sounds too worldly. There's some more spiritual way of saying it, a little bit different than faith. Remembering how they've been kind in previous lives, teaching us to practice virtue and avoid non-virtue, now giving us the teachings, giving us a chance to take ordination, take vows, renew our vows, how to purify and so forth. So when we were talking before, remember we said effort is the sort of like the mother of all good qualities. Like I joked when Saddam Hussein said that his war with America was going to be the mother of all wars, something like that. Remember that? The mother of all good qualities is effort. That's what brings about the good qualities. What's the cause of effort? Aspiration. What's the cause of aspiration? Faith. You need to perceive those qualities and have faith in the faith of conviction in them. Thus, faith is frequently praised in the scriptures and their commentaries as the basis of all auspicious attainments. Okay, so that's the first virtuous mental factor. I remember when I was in Tibet visiting, I'm not sure when it was, I think it was in the late 80s, Lama Zopa had gone to see the Dalai Lama earlier that year, and he always would offer his practice, the practice of the whole FPMT to the Dalai Lama. Do you know what that means, offering your practice? How do you offer your practice? Say you've done virtue. A lot of prostrations, mandala offerings. You've meditated every day. You've been generous. Different kinds of virtuous practice. How can you offer that to the guru? Is that an off? Is that something? Yeah. We say, Milarepa said, I have no possessions to give to the guru. I offer my practice. So one way of offering practice is like we find in the Guru Puja that we'll be doing when tomorrow night. There's a long verse, several lines, I think 8 lines or something, when you imagine your practice and the practice of others as emanating as a beautiful pleasure garden, flowers and, you know, incredibly beautiful fragrances coming through the air like Samantabhadra's offerings. All of your practice coming as in some visible form to bring pleasure to the guru. Or if you understand, that's what really is the meaning of puja. That's what really pleases the guru more than the physical offerings. Knowing that, remember, that's what pleases guru. Just to think of those and think, you know, I offer to you. And imagining the Buddha's mind or the guru's mind being pleased. So sometimes we imagine them as some kind of pleasant things, like a pleasure garden or a beautiful meal or something, because we can imagine more, we can imagine the pleasure that we would have if we experienced those things, right? So we imagine, you know, offering this, our practice in this form to the guru. So I forgot what I was saying that for. I'm going to come back. Okay. So virtuous mental factor is faith. Then the next two are called shame and embarrassment. Shame and embarrassment both act as to prevent you from engaging in negative actions. The difference is shame takes yourself as the reason. Like the same thing, why would you not walk outside naked? You say, I'd be ashamed, right? I'd be ashamed. Why would you? Why? Because somehow it would affect your reputation, maybe. You know, you take yourself as a reason. Another reason might be that your mom or dad, or you know, the neighbors would be upset. So out of consideration for them, you have embarrassment. You'd be embarrassed to do it. Usually, if you say, I'd be ashamed or embarrassed, almost means the same, a little bit different. But here, in fact, you may even use the words in English to refer to the opposite one. But the way that we're talking about the first mental factor is using yourself as a reason to avoid from certain negative activities. Say, for instance, taking to recognize that your negative actions will create negative karma that you yourself will have to experience. Say, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to. Other people want to break some windows or start some fires. I'm not going to do that. Taking yourself as the reason to avoid those negative actions, recognizing that the karma that you would be creating would ripen on you as something uncomfortable. Does that make sense? Then if you were to think, oh, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who have clairvoyance and know what is happening. My guru, who I try to feel is the receptacle of the omniscient mind, it would know. And taking that, them, as your reason for avoiding, is I wouldn't want to displease the guru. You know, I wouldn't want to displease the Buddha. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Do the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas experience displeasure? What do you think? Buddha went? Why not? Doesn't the Buddha, if we take the Buddha as the reason that we're avoiding something because they'd be displeased, you know, like they look down at us, CC, you know, George, why did you do that? I'm disappointed. Are the Buddhas disappointed or displeased? Why not? But say your mom or dad might be very compassionate toward you, but they could still get displeased, right? You broke something, or you snuck in late. You didn't come at the right time. Does that ever happen when you're a kid? Came in too late or something? So I think you're right, though. Geshe Zopa explained once, the Buddhas have omniscient mind. They know what's going to happen. This pleasure means you were expecting something and something else turned up and I'm displeased in you. I was expecting you to be good. So the Buddha knows what's going to happen. But here we're using the word, when we talk about embarrassment, we wouldn't want to recognize that the Buddha knows this. Not so much that they're displeased, it's just that there's a sense of embarrassment, that, oh my gosh, the Buddha would know if I did this action. So these two, have you ever heard of these mental factors? Some of you have studied this before, but some who've not studied mind and mental factors, you may not have heard of this in the Buddha's teachings. Like, this is a very fundamental way of avoiding negative actions, to bring up that thought. This is unsuitable because I'm going to create negative karma. And my reputation will go down, even just in the worldly sense, taking yourself as the cause, but to recognize karma and to take the reason to avoid something that the omniscient mind or your teachers or those that you respect would know this, and to feel embarrassed, I shouldn't do this. Very powerful. Nargarjuna, in writing how the layperson or a king, how they should practice, one of the things he mentioned was that one of the important things is to try to cultivate shame and embarrassment. However you want to translate these words, how are they translated in your lower grade class? Similar? Shame and embarrassment, okay? So what was the first of the 11 mental factors, 11 virtuous mental factors? Faith, then shame and embarrassment. Then we say the three roots of virtue. So let's go non-attachment. Non-attachment doesn't mean simply not having attachment in the mind. The name is a little bit misleading, perhaps. It almost sounds like that, right? Non-attachment. Just, I'm not attached. Non-attachment actually refers to the exact opposite of attachment. The exact opposite of attachment is a wisdom. Attachment is a delusion, just like anger is a delusion, klesha, right? All of the delusions have the tendency of projecting upon their objects. Let's say in the case of attachment, it projects upon its objects. It experiences, the attachment arises when you experience what kind of feeling? When you have bad feelings, you get attached to that? No. When you have pleasant feelings, right? So something that you experience is pleasurable, and then your mind begins to exaggerate. Wow, if I had more of that, like, if I had a lot of that, maybe I'm going to buy all of that off the shelf, You've found some new tasty treat that you. Is anything come to mind? Chocolate or something? You exaggerate the qualities thinking that that would be a source of this continued pleasure. And you want to not the different kinds of attachment, that which wants to get and that which wants to keep what you already have, right? Protect. You're attached to that. You're attached to your companions. You're attached to your reputation. You have attachment for them. So non-attachment is a wisdom that takes away those projections that think, if I had that, I'd always be happy. I would be really happy. Non-attachment is a wisdom consciousness that is, in some ways, in its further developed form, renunciation. So what is renunciation? Do you remember, you know, of the three fundamental qualities of the path? You know, what are the three qualities of the path, three fundamental qualities? Renunciation, bodhicitta, and what? Emptiness? Emptiness, right? Oh, okay, she's catching on now. My teacher Lama Yeshe used to say, emptiness is nothing precious. Everything, even kaka, has emptiness. That's very common. What's uncommon and rare and precious is the wisdom that realizes emptiness. So you're right. Joy's catch could be good. Are you taking the basic program? Yeah, next year you should start. Huh? I don't know when, but next time it starts. Okay. Don't worry. You have time. Yeah, that's true. Okay. You could, good thought. Good thought. So definitely you have to sign up. Even have the wish, have the aspiration to do the basic program. That's great. Virtuous karma. So what is renunciation? So here, non-attachment is an emergence from and a non-desire for cyclic existence and the articles of cyclic existence. It sounds very technical. When we talk about the word renunciation, the actual word that we're translating, I don't remember the Sanskrit, but the actual word in Tibetan is ngejung. Nge means definite, jung means emerge, to definitely emerge. Another way of translating it, though, when you leave home to become a monk or nun, you don't actually have renunciation of all of cyclic existence, but you leave home. It's sort of like you've definitely emerged from the home. So that's called leaving, taking leave, emerging from. So that's okay. Non-attachment has this sense of emerging from being immersed in your attachment and developing a non-desire for it, you know, which is the opposite of the attachment. Let's see if it goes into detail here. So this is the second kind of antidote I wanted to mention. So we talked last time about the antidotes, some of the antidotes to anger, right? In fact, the next of these, non-hatred, so just mention. So non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance, the three roots of virtue, right? So non-hatred is not just the lack of hatred in your mind. Non-hatred is what? Antidote to hatred. It's a wisdom consciousness that is contradicting the projections of hatred and anger through wisdom, seeing how it actually exists, and therefore, you know, as you take away, say for instance, if you hear someone say, "You're a thief, you're a jerk," and you turn around and someone's standing there, and you think they said it. Maybe anger rises, right? If someone says, no, they didn't say it. They show you they had their camera. You know how nowadays people have their cell phone camera on all the time, and you see it was actually someone else that said it. At that point, do you continue being angry at this person? What happened to your anger? I mean, you might be angry at that person, but your anger toward this person disappears because you no longer are projecting upon them that they were the source of your problem, right? So we talked about the antidotes, the various antidotes to bring away, to take away the various projections that instigate anger and hatred last time, right? So the next one, non-hatred, is that all of those kinds of methods would be instances of non-hatred. So non-attachment, though, we didn't talk about yet. So what are the ways that you could get rid of attachment? Okay, one of them overlaps with the four methods of antidotes to anger and hatred, and that was the wisdom. Say, for instance, if you can recognize that the object of your attachment is impermanent, you know? And like when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, not yet Buddha, he was Siddhartha still, right? He was on, what was he on, the path of path of preparation, path of accumulation? I think he was on the path of accumulation, and in that one sitting, he passed into the path of preparation, path of seeing, path of no more learning, path of meditation, path of no more learning. Oh, good. So it sort of looks like she's not paying attention, but she's paying, she knows. So one of the things that happened were these, the Maras, the king, the son of the Devas, is one particular external Mara, tried to seduce the Buddha from attaining enlightenment by emanating these beautiful women, you know, dancing, maybe partially clothed, I don't know, very alluring, very beautiful. And what did the Buddha do? He just ignored them? Do you remember? Did he shoot them? No. He imagined in his mind them, he meditated on impermanence, imagined them growing old. You know, I'm old guy. I never was that attractive as a youth even. But, you know, as you get older, you know, the luster of your skin is gone, there's spots, you know, the hair gets gray. It's nature. And the body sags in various places. It's not the firm skin that you had before. So the Buddha meditated on these beautiful women, and in his mind's eye, he saw them as they would definitely become. So no desire would rise in him. So you can apply that as an antidote also yourself to attachment. Another antidote to attachment is to analyze one of the projections of the mind that makes you interested in the object, this wrong way of thinking, like, wow, that's really nice. Pure, clean, you know, that's just wonderful in all ways, is to analyze the body. They say if there's a person, to analyze the person's body with the scalpel of your mind. And notice that in case this is being recorded and someone might want to use it as evidence, I'm telling you to perform some kind of, you know, cutting up bodies. I'm not talking, I say, with your mind, analyze the body that you're attached to. Take the skin off. Are you still attracted to that body? That's the nature underneath. Look within the various organs, there's various fluids. There's feces in the intestines, there's urine, there's lymphatic fluid, there's spittle in the mouth, there's, you know, crumbs in your ear, and some mucus in your nose, and, you know, all the pores. Once you haven't showered for a while, there's, you know, bad smell coming out of all your pores. Lama Zopa Rinpoche refers to it as, I think he refers to it as eye caca, ear caca, tooth caca, you know, you wake up in the morning, there's some film on your teeth. So recognize that. But even more, and that may seem extreme at first. When you read in the Buddhist teachings and Shantideva's Bodhisattva Charyavatara and other texts to analyze the body that way, you might think, oh man, that's grotesque. Those Buddhists are, the body is beautiful. Come on. Because of one of the projections of our mind is not recognizing that what we are attracted to has parts. And not all of those parts, when you analyze them, you can't find the beauty that you thought was there, the purity, the cleanliness that you thought was there. Like, say, some food, you know, you break it down into its component parts, the molecules and the various ingredients. None of them by themselves are delightful. It's something that you have projected upon it. That food, also thinking in time, will eventually, once you put it in your mouth, say you put the food in your mouth, it's true for a couple of seconds, and you take out, you put down. Do you want to put it back in your mouth again? Maybe if it's almost instantaneous, you know. But if you leave it out for some days, you know, or if I ate something and I offered it to you, you know, as soon as the saliva is on it, it's starting to get chewed up, it's not interesting anymore. And also, once it's gone into your tummy and the gastric juices, it's gone into your intestine and nutrients and taking out, and it's just the fecal matter, you know. That food, you know, I say, here's the pizza, you know. The results, this is the end product of the pizza. You're not interested at all. So to think in that way also, very powerful. That particular meditation on meditating on the body, the impure substances of the body, is a very classic meditation from the time of the Buddha. But many times people think, oh, it's not applicable, I don't want to think of that. It's very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. You can also think of the body in various, what would happen to the body if it's left to decay once the person is dead. You know, the body bloats up and insects come in and so forth and so on, decays. So that to help to overcome the projection of the mind that this is something that's pure, actually that meditation is related with the meditation on empty, what's called empty. Not just emptiness, but empty. It's things, phenomena are empty of being partless. We like to think of things as not having parts, like the person we're attracted to is just one thing, you know, my friend. If you think of the parts, the physical parts, but even nothing there that's really so attractive, you know, the lymph, the muscles, the fat within the body and the bones, there's nothing that's really beautiful. But think, my more effective for my mind is, because often we're attracted to some qualities, mental qualities, personality or something, but we center on certain qualities that we like and we ignore the bad ones. You know, maybe that person is a contaminated phenomenon, right? What does that mean, contaminated? That means that they have arisen because of contaminated karma and delusion. And right now, they are a continuum of that. They have within their mind stream delusions. You know, they may criticize you sometime, although, you know, generally when we talk about guru devotion, they say, how can you develop this kind of respect to the guru, this kind of seeing no faults in the guru. They say, just as with our friends, we see their qualities and ignore their faults. Although later, when those faults come out, they criticize us, or we find they've been stealing from us, or you know they have some other faults, then our opinion changes. Like that, they say, if we focus on the qualities of the guru, those things that seem to be faults will become unapparent to us. Have you heard that teaching before? What is the example that's given? Like in the daytime, like if we look up in the sky in a sunny day, you see the sun. Do you see the stars? Not in the midday. If there was an eclipse of the sun, have you ever seen an eclipse of the sun here? You know what that means when the moon comes in front of the sun during the day? What happens? Of course, it gets dark, darker. Can you see the stars then? Yeah, you can see around. But you know the stars are there, even during the day. Why can't you see the stars during the day? Because you're overpowered by the light of the sun, right? It overpowers the physics of it. It's a little more complicated, but anyway, it's a little bit like overpowering. So if you see the qualities of someone, like a friend, their personality, or they love you, they say sweet words, you know, it's almost as you ignore their faults. Their faults are still there, but you don't pay attention to them. So here, in overcoming attachment, you look at the faults, you analyze them. It doesn't mean that then the next time you see your friend, you say, "You are nothing but a pile of flesh and feces, blood and urine, and you know you have you know." Also, anger, attachment, I have nothing to do with you. What it does is reduce your attachment, though. The superimposition that thinks of the person as pure, also to recognize that they're impermanent, the first of these. Okay? And the third one I find very powerful is to recognize that the object of attachment will not bring you real pleasure. What happens when you experience something that gives you a pleasurable feeling? You could explain it in different ways. Well, because of virtuous karma in the past, like some virtuous arrow you shot when you encountered this morsel of durian, and put it on your tongue, you experience some pleasurable feeling, right? Oh, did you read the article today? I just read just a little. I look sometime on my iPad. It has a thing with newspaper articles you can see, and there was in Indonesia, I think in Northwest Java, some fellow has. I think he studied biology or something. He's made a new strain of durian, and one durian fruit is $1,000. I mean, down in the street they charge like 40 or 50 down here, right? The durian shop. What's the most expensive durian you heard? How much? How much? What did you hear? I thought someone had said, so $1,000 for a durian. So I think they said it the flavor is somewhere between something like combination of peanut and butter. Not peanut butter, but it's like peanuts and butter. Anyway, say when you have when you experience something that's pleasurable, like someone says sweet words to you, "Oh, I love you," or "Oh, you're so smart, you're so nice." Or you experience something, or some physical pleasure, embrace, sexual embrace, or just kissing, or you know, being massaged, or when you experience good taste, or when you're thirsty, drinking something that quenches your thirst. There's the thought that this is real pleasure. But just to recognize that there is, all that is happening is one, you're replacing one suffering with another suffering. The Buddha called this pleasure changeable suffering, right? So to recognize that, even if I had that, I wouldn't really be happy. I would just, you know, sort of reduce one kind of itch. Like if you have an itch and you scratch it, does that sometimes, we think that's pleasurable, right? You say, scratch back here. Oh, yeah, right, that little to the left. Oh. Do you know that what I'm talking about? The kind of experience? So is that real pleasure? If they kept on scratching, there wouldn't be, after a while, you say, stop. My skin is getting scratched, is bleeding, you know, or something like that. So the same thing, if you, whatever the thing is that you think of as a source of pleasure, if you kept on indulging in that, the itch of not having it, the pain of not having it is going down. We call that pleasure. When the pain of having it is still lower, when the pain of having it becomes higher, like the too much scratching or too much durian, we say, I've had enough, you know, no more. I'll explode, you know. So you can apply these kinds of antidotes. Where do these three antidotes come from? Did I just pull them out of the air? Do they sound familiar? When we talked about the truth of suffering, the truth of suffering has, each of the four truths has four aspects. Do you remember? 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. What are the four aspects of the first truth? Impermanence, suffering, empty, and selfless. Do you remember? So here, impermanence was recognizing that this person, like the Buddha meditating under the Bodhi tree, seeing the objects of that were meant to be objects of attachment growing old, that they were definitely understanding that they will end, that this will not endure, this pleasure. Suffering, recognizing the pleasures are actually the nature of suffering. They're changeable suffering. Empty is that the object, the body that we're so attracted to, is empty of being partless. It has phlegm and bones and urine and feces and, you know, muscles. Even you take off the beautiful skin, and you were to, like Shanti Deva said, even if you lay that skin on your cot, your bed, there's no desire to cuddle up to that piece of skin, you know. I mean, maybe some really weird person. You know, now they talk about all these strange. So that is that, and then the ultimate one is selfless. That the object, the person, yourself, the recipient of the pleasure, and the person, if it's a person that you are interested in, or a phenomena that you find pleasure in, like food or whatever, that they are empty of inherent existence. There's nothing really there. It's like trying to find, if you take a plantain tree, do you know a plantain tree? Do you know what plantain is? Kind of tree, it looks like a lot of large leaves coming off. You try to find the middle of it, you take off. In the middle, there's nothing there. You keep on taking off the things. There's no essence there. Like that, if you analyze phenomena, there's no inherently existent quality there the way that your mind thinks. That's an ultimate antidote to attachment. That's an instance of non-attachment. So the three roots of virtue, non-attachment, we just gave some example, non-hatred, we talked about last time, the antidotes, and non-ignorance. So non-ignorance doesn't mean simply the lack of ignorance in your continuum. Non-ignorance is the antidote to ignorance. And what's the main ignorance here? Generally, we talk from the higher point of view, higher tenets point of view, there's two kinds of ignorance. Simply not understanding the law of cause and effect. So maybe you engage in killing and so forth, being ignorant in that sense, in very elemental sense, that's the way that we, and the 12 links, you know the 12 links? What's the first link? Ignorance, then karmic formations, consciousness. So the first link, ignorance, you might think it's just the ignorance of karma, therefore you create negative karma. You're unaware that you're creating. That's not the main ignorance. That is a kind of ignorance, not knowing. But the main ignorance is not simply not knowing. The main kind of ignorance is a distorted wisdom. You might say, hold on, I thought wisdom was good. Remember, wisdom was one of the five object ascertaining mental factors. Is wisdom a virtuous mental factor? No, you can use wisdom to make poison to kill people. You can use wisdom to make bombs. You can use wisdom to cheat others. You know. So, what kind of wisdom is ignorance? You might think wisdom is the opposite of ignorance, right? What kind of wisdom is ignorance? It's a discriminating wisdom which is deluded, which thinks there, let's say, that there is a real self-existent phenomena there to be found. And to, as an antidote to that, you have to have a wisdom that sees what is actually true, that is empty of that quality. So you need to develop the wisdom that realizes emptiness as an antidote to ignorance. So we talked about faith, and then shame, embarrassment, right? The three roots of virtue, we're up to six. Effort, or joyous effort, is a mental delight in virtue. Yes. Can you say what? He didn't turn it on. Yeah.
Wisdom is the same as non-ignorance.
Non-ignorance is a virtuous wisdom.
Yeah.
Ignorance, you might say, is a type of non-virtuous wisdom. Ignorance. Because not just the ignorance of not knowing, but so one kind of ignorance is kind of like just passive, just doesn't know. One kind of ignorance is like active and misapprehending things, you know, like, oh, this is right, it's right to kill, you know, or it's, there is a real thing there, you know, confident, sort of proactive. So that kind of ignorance is a type of deluded wisdom, that ignorance. And that is a non-virtuous wisdom, instance of non-virtuous wisdom. Positive wisdom, virtuous wisdom, that's its antidote, sees the exact, you know, the truth of the situations. The truth of the situation sees that things are, that ignorance is holding, do not exist that way. Okay? Well, let me continue, because just to finish these up. So effort, joyous effort, is a delight in virtue. So for instance, if you expend effort to make money and to just for worldly aims, that from a Buddhist perspective, that's not called joyous effort. You might have joy in that, and you're expending effort. You say, "Yeah, I have joyous effort," but that's not this one. This is a delight in virtue. It has the function of fulfilling and accomplishing virtues. Although in the world, everything that involves striving is called effort. Toil only for the sake of the affairs of this lifetime is not this effort, but is laziness. You know, and again, we're saying, remember I told you that ignorance is kind of wisdom? What the world calls effort, working, toiling to make money, is actually, from a Buddhist perspective, laziness. You might say, oh, George, you've gone too far. Ignorance is wisdom. Effort is laziness. What are you talking about? So working for the happiness of this lifetime is laziness in engaging in virtue, laziness. Effort is the antidote, direct antidote to laziness. Okay. Then just quickly, without going into a lot of detail. So I think that was 7, right? No, 8. Pliancy. Pliancy is a serviceability of mind and body such that the mind can be set on virtuous, on a virtuous object of observation as long as one likes. It has the function of removing all obstructions and has two types. Physical pliancy, when you develop calm abiding, you have a certain kind of ability of the body to do just anything that you want to do without any hesitation. And also you develop a mental pliancy to investigate. You have no problem to remain in meditation. You know, right now we get fatigued. If you try to meditate for a while right now, if you do analytical meditation, you might find some success, but you can't keep it up an awful long time, can you? Maybe, how long can you do analytical meditation on something? 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes? Half hour? Maybe an hour? It depends on how long you've done something. Your mind gets fatigued and you go, I got to take a break. Which is good. You refresh, you have a cup of tea, you look at the sky, you come back. If you have mental pliancy, you can remain for hours, a day, 2 days, completely meditating. You have that ability without getting fatigued. Then, next one is called conscientiousness. Conscientiousness, I sometimes, when I've looked at it in the past, sometimes it looks very similar to shame and embarrassment, but they have a very particular function. Shame and embarrassment, remember the second and third? They avoid non-virtue because of taking oneself as a reason or taking others as a reason. Conscientiousness keeps the mind from contaminations or from keeps your mind away from engaging in negative thoughts and so forth, and causes the achievement of virtue while abiding in effort. Conscientious. We say a conscientious person. Do you use that expression here? Conscientious person is someone who keeps going, so it has a certain relationship with effort, but is, we consider it me that it, the conscientiousness, that factor of mind, is something that helps to prevent you from getting, from losing your momentum, from losing your path due to preventing, you know, discordant states of mind, delusions from arising. And then the 10th, equanimity. Equanimity, I mentioned at the beginning, is not the equanimity when we say, may all sentient beings be free of being too close and too far. You know, when we saw the, what is it called? The equanimity. What is it? The four immeasurable thoughts. Not the immeasurable equanimity. It's not the equanimity of equal feeling between suffering and pleasure. It's a particular mental factor that allows you to let go in meditation. Well, I gave the example of Lama Yeshe. Oh, it wasn't in this class. Lama Yeshe learning how to drive. Lama Yeshe was giving the example that sometime when you first learn to drive, you're so careful, you know, you're pushing your foot on the brake too fast, and then someone says, no, to turn a little to the left, you turn too far, you know, and you're trying to watch all these things. At a certain point, when you get the car running and you've got a little practice, you learn to let go of so much, you know, so much attention to all these things. That's a little bit like equanimity. Okay? So at a certain point in your meditation, you no longer have to apply the antidotes of strict mindfulness and alertness, because it's those factors are taking some of your mental energy from attaining single point of concentration. At a certain point, when you've developed that inertia of the mind, you just let go. That's this mental factor, equanimity. And the last of the 11 factors is the one we started out with tonight, non-harmfulness. Or what do they say in India? Is that what they say, non-harmfulness or... Nonviolence. Ahimsa. Here it's called avihimsa. The V is just an intensifier, VI, or ahimsa. So non-harmfulness is a compassionate attitude included as part of non-hatred, which is a patience, a state of patience devoid of an intention to injure. It observes suffering sentient beings and thinks, may they be free of such suffering. The function of non-harmfulness is not injuring sentient beings. The function of non-harmfulness, not injuring sentient beings, is said to be the essence of Buddha's teachings. So, next, on Thursday, we'll just finish up with how many root delusions are there? Seven? Six. And the secondary delusions? 20. Good. Okay. Have you done the basic program? Oh, okay. Okay. So then. So let's finish up with a little dedication. Calm your mind. See if you can recall, bring back that calm state, that calm place that we try to develop at the beginning by watching the clear light nature of our mind. Just having a memory of it and then using that to actually go back to the mind and looking at its clear light quality. It's very useful if you're going to dedicate the merits to start with this calm state of mind. Think whatever virtues I've created this evening, today, this week, this month, this year, this life, even in the past, I'm going to dedicate them again and again. Dedication means strongly aspiring and wishing that they ripen in a particular way. May they not ripen in such a way that I just experience some superficial happiness, some changeable suffering in cyclic existence that's experienced and brings no benefit, or maybe even becomes a cause of delusions. Whatever way these ripen, may they become the cause of my continued spiritual development. And as I develop spiritually, may I take more cognizance, more attention, pay attention to those around me, develop compassion and love and patience, ever greater as my spiritual path progresses. Due to these merits, practicing in these ways, may I eventually become a Buddha, enlightened being, and effortlessly and spontaneously alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. That's my goal. Okay, thank you very much. So have a good evening. If you have a chance to come on Thursday, see you again. Thanks. And then we'll take a break, I think, for something like 8 days or something, right? And then we'll start some other classes again. So Joseph Lam come to the teacher's office. I'm just joking.